Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. Buckle up, it's about to get spooky. That's because tomorrow, it's back.
If it ever comes back, we'll come back to you.
We didn't stop it.
Pennywise.
The clown. We can't let it happen again.
The highly anticipated It Chapter 2 comes out tomorrow. That's just 4 days before the release of Stephen King's 61st novel, The Institute. There's been a recent cultural renaissance of Stephen King, with the reemergence and remakes of some of his most iconic works. So we're wondering, what is it that's so attractive, so compelling, so enduring about the stories of Stephen King? Well, I asked Tony Magistrale. He's an English and film professor at the University of Vermont, and he's also written 4 books on King's works, published 3 interviews with the author, and even worked as King's research assistant in the mid-2000s, tasked with, get this, researching the history of the haunted house. He says King is part of a long and rich literary tradition.
Oh, boy. You know, he really comes at the culmination of a tradition, I think, that dates back really to the 18th century with the rise of the Gothic novel at the end of the 18th century and its reaction against the age of reason and enlightenment. And King has inherited the great weight of the Gothic novel. It's an incredibly rich tradition, especially as it's perceived in American art and American literature. And you've got enormous influential texts that I think King has responded to in various ways. The vampire tradition and Dracula, of course, and the early romantics, Polidori and Byron. The revival of the dead in Frankenstein. King has read and had been extremely influenced by the horror tradition. And what he's done is allowed that tradition to kind of shape the world that he's created.
I've said you've written many books about Stephen King. Your 2009 book is titled Stephen King, America's Storyteller. What is so American about Stephen King and his writing?
Well, first of all, there's the breadth of it. An American writer who produces novels that are the size of doorstops. You know, he's got a lot to say. And more importantly, more relevant, I think, is the way in which he talks about American culture. I think when people look back on the 20th century, 100 years from now, they'll see King as one of the writers who is able in some way to garner the pulse of American culture in its last throes in the 20th century. What he writes about are subjects that are uniquely American. The idea, for example, of a country that's still trying to find its way, of a country that is saddled with issues like drug and alcohol addiction, that's still working its way through the notion of what it means to be a colossus.
It's interesting you mention late 20th century. Obviously, a lot of King's iconic work takes place in Maine. You've got Derry, which is basically Bangor, Maine, and then some other fictional towns around Maine. You know, Bangor is a town that's 90% white. I'm wondering, America's changing. Do you feel that the relevancy of King's work will change as America changes?
You know, I think King speaks to crisis issues, and he has in a number of his texts, he has worked with the idea of a changing America in terms of its racial configurations. Novels like, for example, The Shining and even It. Speak to dramatic changes that are happening in not only America but also in Bangor to a lesser extent. But I still think you're talking about a regional writer in a lot of ways. This is still a writer whose best work gets to the heart of what it is to be in small town America. Novels like Needful Things and Salem's Lot and It, these are novels that are still talking about the microcosm of small town America. It just happens to be Maine because that's where King is, but it could very easily be Ohio. It could very easily be, like Faulkner, one of his favorite writers, in Yawk-Napatopa, Mississippi.
It's really interesting because when you talk about the long-lasting influence of his work, Stephen King is an author who wasn't always taken very seriously by the horror genre, by mainstream literary critics. We found one interview with the LA Times from 1995 where he actually said, in advance of the release of the movie Dolores Claiborne, 35% of critics will slam this movie just because it's Stephen King. So he was very aware that there was a certain stigma attached to his name. Why do you think that was? Why was he dismissed?
Because he's amazingly successful. You know, a guy who sells enough books to make $57 million in a year can't be taken seriously, can he? and you know, what you have to remember, I think, is that there are two strains of Stephen King that are at work in contemporary America. The first strain is the literary strain, but there's also the cinematographic strain that's at work. His work has been responsible for the production of adaptations that have become part of the American cinematographic pantheon. And I'm thinking of films like Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, Stand By Me, and even, I'm sorry for this, Steve, if you're listening, The Shining.
I know he hates that one. I'm glad you mentioned Shawshank. I want to play a quick cut of that. This is the movie from 1994. You have Red, who's played by Morgan Freeman, speaking with Andy, played by Tim Robbins, about his dreams of getting out of prison and heading to Mexico.
I don't think you ought to be doing this to yourself, Andy. I mean, Mexico is way to hell down there, and you're in here, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, right. That's the way it is. It's down there, and I'm in here. I guess it comes down to a simple choice, really. Get busy living, or get busy dying.
So King is often pigeonholed as a horror writer, but really he's so much more than that, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. I mean, we could go through the various subgenres that are connected to King's work besides horror. We could also talk about the way in which he works the Western traditions in novels like The Dark Tower. But speaking of that clip that you just played, is there anyone writing in America today who writes better about prisons than Stephen King? Even a novel like a novella like The Mist, which is set in a supermarket during an apocalyptic storm, is a prison. And prisons are everywhere in Stephen King. Sometimes they're self-made, but they're everywhere in his work.
So I want to ask you about adaptations because
sure.
So much of Stephen King's work has been turned into movies and miniseries. I want to play something from the opening scene from the 2017 It Chapter One. 6-year-old Georgie first meets Pennywise, played by Bill Skarsgård, when his boat floats into a sewer.
Do you want a balloon tour, Georgie?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers.
I'm Pennywise, the dancing clown. Pennywise? Yes, meet Georgie. Georgie, meet Pennywise. Now we aren't strangers, are we?
Pennywise, the source of so many adult fears of clowns that last through their entire life.
Oh, boy. Stay clear of that clown, Georgie.
It is a movie that made $700 million at the box office. Do you agree with folks that say we're in a renaissance of King's work? You had Pet Sematary came out in the spring. You got the miniseries Castle Rock, The Dark Tower. It Chapter 2 is obviously coming out tomorrow. Do you agree with that, or do you think that there's always been a constant interest?
We've never left Stephen King, and he's never left us. It's just that sometimes there's an ebb and sometimes there's a flow. And right now, we're in a flood. And it's coming in, you know, in these films like Pet Sematary and It. It needed a readaptation. The first one wasn't sufficient. It wasn't good enough. I think this one's much better.
Well, you're not the only fan of It Chapter One. Stephen King himself was a fan of that remake. He recently did an interview with Movie Clips and talked about what he thought made it so successful.
One of the things that I wanted to do in the novel, in all of my novels, is to create characters who were fundamentally decent, by and large. And that way, you don't want them to be spam in a cabin. You know, you don't want them wiped out. You want them to live and you want them to win. And I think that that translates to the film.
I'm curious. I was reading one critic who says he believes that King has become more optimistic in his later years. Do you think that that's true, or do you think that that's always been there buried under the kind of slash gore horror stuff?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's always been the sentimental Steve. Steve can't let the kid die in Cujo. And I guess I just want to disagree with Mr. King respectfully. Please, could I emphasize the word respectfully? I don't think it's those fundamentally good characters are what draws people to it in particular. I think it's Pennywise. I think we're drawn to Pennywise in all of his various manifestations because we're fascinated with evil. We're living in a time of utter chaos, really, especially in this country. And what Steve is doing is essentially tapping in to those anxieties and fears that are part of postmodern America.
So I want to play a cut from another recent remake. This is 2019's Pet Sematary. It stars Jason Clarke as Dr. Lewis Creed. So this is a scene where he's reintroducing his wife named Rachel to their daughter who had died, but now's returned home reanimated.
There's a place, Rach, deep in the woods, beyond the Pet Sematary. It brings things back.
Aren't you happy, Mommy?
Rachel!
She doesn't want me here.
No. Mommy just needs time.
It's okay. I don't want her here either.
This is one of King's darker works.
Yeah.
Pet Sematary didn't quite get the same box office success of It. I'm wondering why have some not been as successful as others?
Well, it's tapping into some sort of primal fear, I think. Maybe it's the John Wayne Gacy fear of clowns that all adults have. Maybe it's the idea of a town that's turned inside out. And Pet Sematary, if we come back to that first question you asked me, Chris, about King's literary legacy. You can't have Pet Sematary without Hawthorne. The great Massachusetts writer who wrote stories about going into the woods and being transformed. In America, we didn't have haunted houses. We didn't have Gothic castles. So Hawthorne had to rely on the woods. And King's borrowing heavily, I think, from that transcendent element that so often appears in Hawthorne. And anyone who has an appreciation for New England is going to see that those woods are scary, dark, and deep. I mean, Robert Frost saw that. And where King takes us in a story like Pet Sematary is into a place where the woods are not only dark and deep, but also capable of changing us, transforming us, as they do inexorably in Hawthorne.
So you've talked a lot about writers and works that influence King. I'm curious how you see King's influence on current pop culture. I know when I'm watching something like Stranger Things, I can't help but think this is an extension of Stephen King's work.
King has been such an influence on American culture that I think the only way you can connect it is with people like the Beatles. So if you think you've got a whole generation of writers that have been brought up on Stephen King, a steady diet of Stephen King. But I also think you have a whole genre of cinema that has been the result of King's involvement. Stranger Things, you've already mentioned, but the whole horror tradition that has been produced since, I think, the slasher films in the 70s owes something to Steve. There's something about what he's producing in his fiction that is connecting to the anxieties and the fears of a contemporary American culture. He's also producing hope. There's a great tradition of hope in King's work, and hope is a good thing, and no good thing ever dies, right?
That's Tony Magistrale. He's an English and film professor at the University of Vermont. He's also written 4 books on King's works, the latest of which is The Shawshank Experience, tracking the history of the world's favorite movie. Tony, thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure talking to you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.